Andy hissed at the world in general. "Could I regretfully remind you, gentlemen, that I have another hand?" said Nutt. He must have squeezed because Andy yelped as his hand ground against the weapon's handle. Trev knew all too well that Andy did not have friends. He had followers. They were looking at their stricken leader, and they were looking at Nutt. And they could see very clearly not only that Nutt had a spare hand, but what he was capable of doing with it. They did not move. "Very well," said Nutt. "Perhaps this has been nothing more than an unfortunate misunderstanding. I am about to release my grip. Just enough for you to drop the cutlass, Mr. Andy, please." There was another intake of breath from Andy as the cutlass landed on the stones. "Now, if you would excuse us, Mr. Trev and I are going to walk away."
"Take the bloody cutlass! Don't leave the cutlass on the ground," said Trev.
"I'm sure Mr. Andy would not come after us," said Nutt.
"Are you bloody mad?"
said Trev. He reached down, snatched up the cutlass, and said, "Let him go, and let's get a move on."
"Very well," said Nutt. He must have squeezed a little harder, because now Andy slumped to his knees.
Trev pulled Nutt away and towed him through the permanent city crowd.
"That's Andy," he said, hurrying them along. "You don't expect logic with Andy. You don't expect him to learn the error of his ways. Don't look for any sense when Andy's after you. Got that? Don't try talking to him as if he's a human being. Now keep up with me."
Dwarf shops were doing well these days, largely because they understood the first rule of merchandising, which is this. I have got goods for sale, and the customer has got money. I should have the money, and, regrettably, that involves the customer having my goods. To this end, therefore, I will not say the one in the window is the last one we have and we can't sell it to you, because if we did, no one would know we have them for sale, or we'll probably have some more on Wednesday, or we just can't keep them on the shelves, or I'm fed up with telling people there's no demand for them. I will make a sale by any means short of physical violence, because without one, I'm a waste of space. Glang Snorrison lived by this rule, but he didn't like people much, an affliction that affects many who have to deal with the general public over a long period. And the two people on the other side of his counter were making him edgy. One was small and looked harmless, but something so deep down in Glang's psyche that it was probably stuffed in his jeans was making him nervous. The other, in true customer, was not much more than a boy, and therefore likely to commit a crime any moment. Glang dealt with the situation by not understanding anything they said, and uttering silly insults in his native tongue. There was hardly a risk. Only the watch learned dwarfish, and it came as a surprise when the worryingly harmless one said, in better Chlamydos dwarfish than Glang himself spoke these days, "Such incivility to the amiable stranger shames your beard and erases the writings of Tack, ancient merchant."
"What did you say to him?" Trev asked, as Glang spluttered out apologies.
"Oh, just a traditional greeting," said Nutt. "Could you pass me the ball, please?"
He took the football and bounced it on the floor.
Gloing.
"I suspect you might know the trick of making brimstone rubber."
"That was my grandfather's name," Glang stuttered.
"Ah, a good omen," said Trev quickly. He caught the ball and batted it down again.
Gloing.
"I can cut out and stitch the outer cover if you will work on the bladder," said Nutt, "and we will pay you $15 and allow you a license to make as many more as you wish."
"You'll make a fortune," said Trev encouragingly.
Glowing, glowing, went the ball, and Trev added,
"That'd be a university license too. No one would dare mess with it."
"How come you know about brimstone rubber?" said Glang.
He had the look about him of someone who knows that he is outnumbered, but will go down fighting.
"Because King Rhys of the Dwarfs presented a dress of brimstone rubber and leather to Lady Margalotta 6 months ago, and I'm pretty sure I understand the principle."
The Dark Lady? She can kill people with a thought."
"She is my friend," said Nutt calmly, "and I will help you."
Glenda wasn't quite sure why she tipped the troll tuppence. He was elderly and slow, but his upholstery was well kept, and he had twin umbrellas. And it was no fun for trolls to come this far, because the kid gangs would have graffitied them to the waist by the time they got out of there. She felt hidden eyes on her as she walked up to her door, and it didn't matter.
"All right," she said to Juliet. "Have a night off, okay?" "I'll go back to work with you," said Juliet to her surprise. "We need the money, and I can't tell Dad about the $50, can I?"
There was a small collision of expectations in Glenda's head as Juliet went on,
"You're right. It's a steady job, and I want to keep it. And I'm so thick I'd probably muck up the other one. I mean, it was fun and all that, but then I thought, well, you always gave me good advice. And I remembered that time you kicked Greasy Damon in the ghoulies so hard when he was messing me around. He walked bent double for a week. Besides, if I go away with them, it means leaving the street, and Dad and the lads. That's really scary. And you said, be careful about fairy stories, and you're right, half the time it's goblins. And I don't know how I'd get on without you putting me right. You're a solid, you are. I can't remember you not being around. And when one of the girls sniggered about your old coat, I told her you worked very hard.
Glenda thought, I used to be able to read you like a book, one with big colourful pages and not many words. And now I can't. What's happening? You're agreeing with me, and I ought to feel smug about it, but I don't. I feel bad about it, and I don't know why, and that hurts.
Maybe you ought to sleep on it, she suggested.
No, I'd mess it up, I know I would.
Do you feel all right? Something inside Glenda was shouting at her.
I'm okay, said Juliet. Oh, it was fun and that, but it's for knobby girls, not me. It's all glitter, nothing you can hold. But a pie's a pie, right? Solid. Besides, you'd look after Dad and the lads.
No, 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 screamed Glenda's voice in her own head. Not that, I didn't want that. Oh, didn't I? Then what did I think I was doing, passing on all that old toot? She looks to me, and I've gone and given her a good example.
Why?
Because I wanted to protect her. She's so vulnerable. Oh, dear, I've taught her to be me, and I've even made a bad mess of that chore.
All right, then, you can head back with me.
Will we see the banquet? Our dad's been fretting about the banquet. He reckons Lord Vetinari is going to have everybody murdered.
Does he do that a lot?
Yeah, but it gets hushed up, our dad says.
There's going to be hundreds of people there. That would need a lot of hush.
And if I don't like what I hear, there won't be enough hush in all the world, she thought.
Trev mooched aimlessly around the shop while Nut and the dwarf put their heads together over the ball. For some reason, there was a faint scrabbling on the roof. It sounded like claws. Just a bird, he told himself. Even Andy wouldn't come in through the roof. There was another pressing matter. This place would have a privy, wouldn't it? There was at least a back door, and that would inevitably lead to a back alley, and, well, what is a back alley for, except for sleeping tramps and the call of nature? Possibly in the same place if you were feeling cruel. Trev unbuckled his belt, faced a noisome wall, and stared upwards nonchalantly, as a man does in these circumstances. However, most men don't look up into the astonished faces of two bird-like women who were standing, no, perching on the roof. They screeched, "Ork! Ork!" and flew up into the darkness. Trev scuttled quickly and damply back into the shop. This city got bloody stranger every day. After that, time flew past for Trev, and every second stank of sulphur. He'd seen Nut dribbling candles, but that was at snail's pace compared with the speed at which the leather was cut for the ball. But that wasn't creepy, that was just Nut. What was creepy was that he didn't measure anything. Eventually, Trev couldn't stand it any more, and stopped leaning against the wall, pointed to one of the multi-sided little leather strips, and said,
"How long is that?"
1 15/16 of an inch.
How can you tell without measuring?
I do measure, with my eyes. It is a skill. It can be learned.
And that makes you worthy?
Yes.
And who judges?
I do.
There we are, Mr. Nut, still warm,
said Glang, arriving from the back of the shop holding something that looked like something taken from an animal that was now, you hoped for its own sake, dead.
Of course, I could do a lot better with more time, he continued, but if you blow down this little tube...
Trev watched in wonder, and it occurred to him that in all his life he'd made a few candles and a lot of mess. How much was he worth? Glowing, glowing. Two balls in harmony, thought Trev, but clapped as Nut and Glang shook hands. Then, while they were still admiring their handiwork, he reached behind him and slipped a dagger off the bench and into his pocket. He wasn't a thief. Oh, fruit off stalls, but everyone knew that didn't count. And picking a toff's pocket was just a case of social redistribution. Everyone knew that, too. And maybe you found something that looked lost. Well, someone would pick it up, so why not you? Weapons got you killed, often because you were holding one. But things were going too far. He had heard Andy's bones creak, and Nut had brought the man to his knees without sweating. And there were two reasons for taking precautions right there. One was that if you put Andy down, you'd better put him out, right out, because he would come back, blood around the corner of his mouth. And two, the worst, was that right now Nut was more worrying than Andy. At least he knew what Andy was. Carrying a ball each, they hurried back to the university, with Trev keeping a watchful eye on high buildings.
"It's amazing what's turning up in this city," he said. "There were a couple of vampire types back there, did you know?"
"Oh, those, they work for Ladyship. They are there for protection."
"Whose?"
said Trev. "Do not worry about them."
"Ha! And do you know something even stranger has happened this evening?"
said Trev, as the university hove into sight.
"You offered that dwarf $15, and he didn't even haggle. Like, that's unheard of. Must be the power of glowing.
Yes, but I actually gave him $20, said Nut.
Why? He didn't ask for anything more.
No, but he did work very hard, and the extra $5 will more than repay him for the dagger you stole while our backs were turned.
I never did, said Trev hotly.
Your automatic, unthinking, and spring-loaded reply is noted, Mr. Trev, as was the sight of the dagger on the bench, shortly followed by the sight of the empty space where the dagger had been. I'm not angry, because I saw you most sensibly toss Mr. Shanks's wretched cutlass over a wall, and I understand your nervousness, but nevertheless, I must point out that this is stealing. And so I ask you, as my friend, to take the dagger back in the morning.
But that will leave him up by $5 and his dagger back, Trev sighed.
But at least we've got a few dollars each, he said, as they entered the back door of the university.
Yes, and then again no, Mr. Trev. You will take the remaining $5 and this rather grubby, although genuine, receipt for $20 to Mr. Stibbons, who thinks you are no good, thus making him doubt his original assumption that you are a thief and a scallywag, and assisting your progress in this university.
I'm not a... Trev began and stopped, honest enough to acknowledge the knife in his coat.
Honestly, Nut, you're one of a kind, you are.
Yes, said Nut. I'm coming to that conclusion.
Watcher! The word in huge type shouted out from the front page of the Times, next to a big picture of Juliet glittering in micromail and smiling right at the reader. Glenda, frozen for the last 15 seconds in the act of raising a piece of toast to her mouth, finally bit. Now she blinked and dropped the toast to read, Mystery Model Jules was the toast of an astounding fashion show at Shatter yesterday, when she was the very incarnation of micromail. The remarkable metal cloth about which there has been so much speculation in recent months, and which, she confirms, does not chafe. She chatted happily and with fetching straightforward earthiness to dignitaries to whom, this writer is certain, no one has ever said watcher before. They appeared to find the experience refreshing and entirely without chafe. Glenda stopped reading at this point because the question, how much trouble are we going to get into about this, was attempting to fill her whole head. And there was no trouble, was there? And there would not be. There couldn't be. First, who would think that the beauty in the silver beard, like some goddess of the forge, was a cook's assistant? And second, there was no trouble to be had, unless someone tried to make it, in which case they would have to go through Glenda, and Glenda would go through them in very short order. Because Jules was wonderful. She had to admit it. The girl brought radiant sunshine to the page, and suddenly it was plain. It would be a crime to hide all that grace and beauty in a cellar. So what if she had a vocabulary of fewer than 700 words? There were more than enough people who were stuffed tight as an egg with words, and who would want to see any of them on the front page? Anyway, she thought, as she pulled her coat on, it would be a 9-minute wonder in any case, and besides, she added to herself, it wasn't as if anyone would spot it was Juliet. After all, she was wearing a beard, and that was amazing, because there was no way that a woman in a beard should look attractive. But it worked. Imagine that catching on. You'd have to spend twice as long at the hairdresser's. Someone's going to think about that, she thought. There was no sound from the Stollops house. She wasn't surprised. Juliet did not have much grasp of the idea of punctuality. Glenda popped next door to see how the widow Crowdie was, and then headed, in the drizzling rain, back to her safe haven of the night kitchen. Halfway there, an all-but-forgotten pressure in her bodice reminded her of her duty, and she dared to go into the Royal Bank of Ankh Morpork. Trembling with fear and defiance, she walked up to a clerk at his desk, slapped 50 warm dollars in front of him and said, I want to start a bank account, all right? She left 5 minutes later with a shiny account book and the delightful recollection that a posh-looking man at a posh-looking desk in a posh-looking building had called her madam, and enjoyed the sensation until it ran into the reality that madam had better roll up her sleeves and get to work. There was a lot to do. She made pies at least a day ahead so that they could mature, and Mr. Nutt's appetite last night had put quite a large dent in her pantry. But at least there wouldn't be much demand for pies tomorrow night. Even the wizards didn't call for a pie after a banquet. Ah, yes, the banquet, she thought, as the rain started to soak into her coat. The banquet. She would have to see about the banquet. Sometimes, if you wanted to go to the ball, you had to be your own fairy godmother. There were several obstacles requiring the touch of a magic wand. Mrs. Whitlow did indeed operate a certain kind of apartheid between the night and day kitchens, as if one flight of stairs actually changed who you were.
The next difficulty was that Glenda did not have, according to the traditions of the university, the right kind of figure to serve at table, at least when there were visitors. And, lastly, Glenda did not have the temperament for serving at table. It wasn't that she didn't know how to smile. She was quite capable of smiling, if you gave her enough warning. But she positively hated having to smile at people who actually merited, instead, a flick around the earhole with a napkin. She hated taking away plates of unfinished food. She always had to suppress a tendency to say things like, "Why did you put it on your plate if you didn't intend to finish it?" And, "Look, you've left more than half of it, and it cost $1 a pound. And, "Of course it's cold, but that's because you've been playing footsie with the young lady opposite and haven't been concentrating on your dinner." And when all else failed, "There's little children in clatch, you know." It was a phrase of her mother's, but she'd obviously missed some significant part of it. She hated waste, she thought to herself as she walked along the stone corridor towards the night kitchen. There never needed to be any if you knew your way around a kitchen and if your diners had the decency to take your food seriously. She was rambling to herself. She knew that. Occasionally, she would pull the front page of the Times out of her bag and take a look at it again. It had all really happened, and there was the proof. But it was a funny thing. Every day something happened that was important enough to be on the front page of the newspaper. She'd never bought it and seen a little sign that said, "Not much happened yesterday, sorry about that." And tomorrow, wonderful though that picture was, it would be wrapping up fish and chips, and everyone would have forgotten about it. That would be a load off her mind. There was a polite cough. She recognised it as belonging to Nutt, who had the politest cough there could possibly be. "Yes, Mr. Nutt." "Mr. Trevor sent me with this letter for Miss Juliet, Miss Glenda," said Nutt, who had apparently been waiting by the steps. He held it out as if it were some double-edged sword. "She's not come in yet, I'm afraid," said Glenda, as Nutt followed her up the steps. "But I'll put it on the shelf over here where she'll be bound to see it." She looked at Nutt and saw his eyes firmly fixed on the pyrex. "Oh, and I do seem to have made one apple pie more than called for. I wonder if you would assist me by removing it from the premises." He gave her a grateful smile, took the pie, and hurried away. Alone again, Glenda looked at the envelope. It was the cheapest sort, the kind that looked as if it had been made from recycled lavatory paper, and somehow it seemed to have got a bit bigger. Inexplicably, she found herself recalling that the gum on those envelopes was so bad when it came to sealing them, it was probably better just to have a very bad cold. Anyone could simply open it up, see what it said, dig out a bit of earwax, and no one would be any the wiser. But that would have been a very bad thing to do. Glenda thought that same thought 15 times before Juliet walked into the night kitchen, hung up her coat on the hook, and put on her apron. "There was a man on the bus reading the paper, and had a picture of me on the front," she said excitedly. Glenda nodded and handed over her own paper. "Well, I suppose it's me," said Juliet, with her head on one side. "What shall we do now?" "Open the damn letter!" shouted Glenda. "What?" said Juliet. "Trev sent you a letter," said Glenda. She snatched it from the shelf and held it out. "Why don't you read it right now?"
"He's probably just mucking about."
"No, why don't you just read it right now?" "I haven't tried to open it." Juliet took the envelope. It opened more or less to a touch. Glenda's evil side thought, "Hardly any gum at all. I could have just flicked it open."
"I can't read with you standing so close," said Juliet.
After some time moving her lips, she went on,
"I don't get it. It's all kind of long words. Lovely curly writing, though. There's a bit here saying that I look like a summer's day. What's that all about, then?"
She pressed it into Glenda's hand.
"Can you read it for me, Glendy? You know I'm not good at complicated words."
"Well, I'm a bit busy," said Glenda. "But since you ask—"
"First time I've ever had a letter that's not all in capitals," said Juliet.
Glenda sat down and started to read. A lifetime of what even she would call bad romantic novels suddenly bore fruit. It read as though someone had turned on the poetry tap and then absent-mindedly gone on holiday. But they were wonderful words, nevertheless. There was the word swain, for example, which was a definite marker, and quite a lot about flowers and quite a lot of what looked like pleading, wrapped up in fancy letters, and after a while she took out her handkerchief and fanned the air around her face.
"So what's it all about?" said Juliet.
Glenda sighed. How to begin? How did you talk to Juliet about similes and metaphors and poetic license all wrapped up in wonderful curly writing? She did her best.
"Well, basically he's saying that he really fancies you, thinks you're really fit, how about a date, no anky-panky, promises. And there's three little X's underneath."
Juliet started to cry.
"That's lovely. Fancy him sitting down and writing all those words just for me. Real poetry, just for me. I'm going to sleep with it under my pillow."
Yes, I suspect that he had something like that in mind, said Glenda, and thought, Trev likely a poet, not likely at all. There was a dreadful load on Pepe's bladder, and he was stuck between a rock and a hard place, if that wasn't too offensive a description of lying between Madame and a wall. She was still asleep. She snored magnificently, using the traditional multi-part snore, known to those who are fortunate enough to have to listen to it every night as a symphony. And she was lying on his leg, and the room was pitch dark. He managed to retrieve his leg, half of which had gone to sleep, and set out on the well-known search for porcelain, which began by him putting his foot down on an empty champagne bottle, which skittered away and left him flat on his back. In the gloom he groped for it, found it, tested it for true emptiness because you never knew your luck, and, as it were, filled it again, putting it down on what was probably a table, but in his mind and the darkness could just as well have been an armadillo. There was another sound syncopating with Madame's virtuoso performance. It must have been that which woke him. By groping, he located his shorts, and after only three tries, managed to get them the right way up and the right way round. They were a little chilly. That was the problem with micromail. It was, after all, metal. On the other hand, it did not chafe, and you never had to wash it. 5 minutes on the fire, and it was as hygienic as anything. Besides, Pepe's version of the shorts held a surprise all of their own. Thus feeling that he could face the world, or at least the part of it that would need to see only the top of him, he shuffled and stubbed his way to the shop's door, checking every bottle along the way for evidence of liquid content. Remarkably, a bottle of port had survived with 50% remaining capacity. Any port in a storm, he thought, and drank his breakfast. The shop's door was rattling. It had a small sliding aperture by which the staff could determine whether they wanted to let a prospective customer in, because when you are a posh shop like Chatter, you don't sell things to just anyone. Pairs of eyeballs zigzagged back and forth across his vision as people clustered on the other side of the door and fought for attention. Somebody said, "We're to see Jules." "She's resting," said Pepe. That was always a good line and could mean anything. "Have you seen the picture in the Times?" said a voice. "Then look," as a vision of Juliet was held up in front of the door. "Blimey," he said to himself. "She had a very tiring day," he said. "The public wants to know all about her," said a sterner voice. And a rather less aggressive female voice said, "She seems to be rather amazing." "She is, she is," said Pepe, inventing desperately. "But a very private person and a bit artistic too, if you know what I mean." "Well, I've got a big order to place," said yet another voice, as the owner managed to shuffle for slot space. "Oh, well, we don't have to wake her up for that. Just give me a moment and I'll be right with you." He took another swig of the port. When he turned around, Madame, in a nightshirt that could have accommodated a platoon, at least if they were very friendly, was bearing down on him with a glass in one hand and the champagne bottle in the other. "This stuff's gone horribly flat," she said. "I'll go and find some fresh," he replied, snatching it from her quickly. "We've got newspaper people and customers out there, and they all want jewels. Can you remember where she lives?"
"I'm sure she told me," said Madame, "but it all seems a long time ago. That other one, Glenda, I think, works at some big place in the city as a cook. Anyway, why do they want to see her?"
"There's a wonderful picture in the Times," said Pepe. "You know when you said you thought we'd get rich? Well, it looks like you weren't thinking big enough."
"What do you suggest, dear?"
"Me," said Pepe. "Take the order, because that's good business, and tell the others that Jules will see them later."
"Do you think they'll go for that?"
"They'll have to, because we don't know where the hell she is. There's $1 million walking around this city on legs."
Rhys, low king of the dwarfs, paid particular attention to the picture of the wonderful girl. The definition wasn't too bad at all. The technique of translating the clack's semaphore signal into a black-and-white picture was quite well advanced these days. Even so, his people in Ankh-Morpork must have thought this particularly interesting to merit the expense of the bandwidth required. Certainly, it was exercising a lot of other dwarfs, but in the Low King's experience, it was possible to find someone, somewhere, who objected to anything. He looked at the grags in front of him. So simple for people like Vetinari, he thought. He just has religions to deal with. We don't have religions. Being a dwarf is a religion in itself, and no two priests ever agree. And sometimes it seems that every other dwarf is a priest. "I see nothing here to disturb me," he said.
"We believe the beard to be a false one," said one of the grags.
"That is perfectly acceptable," said the king.
"There is absolutely nothing in any precedent that bans false beards. They are a great salvation to those who find beards hard to grow.
But she looks, well, alluring, said one of the other Greggs.
They were indistinguishable under their tall, pointed leather cowls.
Attractive, certainly, said the king. Gentlemen, is this going to take long?
It must be stopped. It's not dwarfish.
Oh, but it manifestly is it not, said the king. Micromale is 100% male, and you don't get any more dwarfish than that. She is smiling, and while I would agree that dwarfs do not appear to smile very much, certainly not when they come to see me, I think we could profit from her example.
It's positively an offence against morality.
How? Where? Only in your heads, I feel.
The tallest Grag said,
So you intend to do nothing?
The king paused for a moment, staring at the ceiling.
No, I intend to do something, he said. First of all, I shall see to it that my staff find out just how many orders there have been for micromail originating from here in Bjonk today. I'm sure Shatter would not object to them seeing their records, especially since I intend to tell Madame Shan that she can come back and establish her premises here.
You would do that, said a Grag.
Yes, of course. We have nearly concluded the Coombe Valley Accord, a peace with the trolls that no one ever thought they would see. And I am fed up, gentlemen, with your whining, moaning, and endless attempts to refight battles that you've already lost. As far as I am concerned, this young lady is showing us a better future. And now, if you are not out of my office in 10 seconds, I will charge you rent.
There'll be trouble over this.
Gentlemen, there is always trouble. But this time, I will be making it for you.
As the door slammed shut behind them, the king sat back in his chair.
"Well done, sir," said his secretary. "They'll keep on. I can't imagine what being a dwarf would be like if we didn't argue all the time."
He squirmed a little in his chair.
"You know, they're right when they say it doesn't chafe, and it's not as cold as you would imagine. Do ask our agent to express my thanks to Madame Shan for her generous gift, will you?"
Even this early in the day, the great hall of the university was a general thoroughfare. Most of the tables were pushed back against the walls, or, if someone felt like showing off, levitated to the ceiling. And the huge black-and-white slabs of the floor, worn smooth by the footfalls of millennia, were polished still further as today's faculty and students took a short cut to various concerns, destinations, and, very occasionally when no viable excuse presented itself, to lectures. The great chandelier had been swung down and off to one side for its daily replenishing of candles, but there was, fortunately for Mustrum Ridcully's purposes, a large expanse of clear floor. He saw the figure he was waiting for hurrying towards him.
"How did it go, Mr. Stibbons?"
"Extremely well, I have to say, sir," said Ponder. He opened the sack he was carrying. "One of these is our original ball, and one of them is the ball that Nutt and Trevor Likely had made last night."
"Ah, spot the ball," said Ridcully.
He picked them both up in his enormous hands and dropped them onto the flagstones. Glowing, glowing.
"Perfectly identical," he said.
"Trevor Likely said they had it made by a dwarf at $20," said Ponder.
"Did he really?"
"Yes, sir, and he gave me the change and the receipt."
"You seem puzzled, Mr. Stibbons."
"Well, yes, sir. I feel I have been rather misjudging him."
"Possibly even small leopards can change their shorts," said Ridcully, slamming him on the back convivially. "Call it score one for human nature. Now, which of these balls is the one that's going back to the cabinet?"
"Amazingly, sir, they did think to mark the new ball, and there's a tiny little dot of white paint on this one here. I mean this one here. I think it was here. Ah, here it is. It's ours. I'll send one of the students to put the other one back shortly. We still have an hour and a half."
"No, I'd rather you did it yourself, Mr. Stibbons. I'm sure it would only take a few minutes. Do hurry back. I'd like to try a little experiment."
When Ponder returned, he found Ridcully loitering unobtrusively by one of the big doors.
"You have your notebook ready, Mr. Stibbons?" he said quietly.
"And a fresh pencil, Arch-Chancellor."
"Very well, then. The experiment begins."
Ridcully gently rolled the new football out onto the floor, straightened up and glanced at his stopwatch.
"Ah, the ball has been kicked aside by the Professor of Illiberal Studies, quite possibly by accident. Now one of the Bledlows, Mr. Hipney, I think his name is, has kicked it somewhat uncertainly. One of the students, Pondlife, I believe, has prodded it back. We have momentum, Mr. Stibbons. Undirected, it is true, but promising. Ah, but we can't have this.
No touching the ball with your hands, gentlemen," shouted the Arch-Chancellor, deftly trapping the travelling ball with his boot. "That's a rule. We really could do with that whistle, Stibbons."
He bounced the ball on the stone floor. Gloing.
Don't just mess about like kids kicking a tin. Play football. I am the Arch-Chancellor of this university, and by Io, I will rusticate or otherwise expel any man who skives off without a note from his mother. Ha! Gloing.